Welcome to the Learning Scientist Podcast, a podcast for teachers, students, and parents about evidence-based practice and learning.
Hi, welcome to the Learning Scientist Podcast. This is Megan Samaraki, a professor at Rhode Island College, and today I am joined by Natalia Kucherkova, and I'm sure that I botched the pronunciation of her name. I'm going to have her say it again as well. She is a professor of early childhood and development at University of Stavanger. I'm horrific with pronunciation, so I'm going to let her say all of that again. And then she is going to tell us about a network that she runs and research related to artificial intelligence, what has been done, what has not been done, what we can say in terms of student learning and improvements, a lot of really interesting things that are on the very top of people's minds these days. So Natalia, could you please introduce yourself and pronounce everything beautifully as you did before we started recording?
Oh, sure. Yes. And thanks so much for having me on. So my name is Natalia Ingebretsen-Kucherkova. I work at the University of Stavanger here in Norway and also in the UK at the Open University. And I also work a lot actually in the US and in other countries looking at the importance of science-based literacy materials and making sure that the educational technologies at tech that are used in classrooms are based on latest research. So that's the topic that I'm keen to highlight when we discuss networks, as you said at the beginning.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about this network. My understanding is it's based at your university, but it's international. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it actually started with the International Collective of Children's Digital Books. So my background is in digital literacy. As a professor, I've been looking at various apps and platforms that are designed to increase children's reading comprehension, vocabulary learning, and other literacy skills. And as part of that work, we have seen this need for working very closely with the industry partners. So people who actually develop these early reading apps, phonics apps, digital stories. We set up this network of researchers, developers, and teachers who work together to enhance children's digital books and digital literacy resources. And we call it the International Collective of Children's Digital Books. So if people are interested in this, this is a free think tank network to join. It's on the childrensdigitalbooks.com website. But from that network, we have grown it into a network of networks, if you like, where we get not only children's digital books, but also other types of edtech resources. So following the same model that we really want to include both the teachers' voices, the researchers' voices, and the founders or the developers' insights when creating various digital tools for young children. So the second network I'm describing here is called Wicked, as in the wicked complex problem of edtech solutions that are out there and not necessarily based on research or evidence. So we want to solve or at least address this problem by bringing people together through these networks.
Excellent. It's so interesting the way that you've brought a lot of researchers together and a lot of these different perspectives together to try to solve these problems, because we talk all the time about how one particular focus of expertise isn't going to be enough. We need researchers and educators and administrators and all of these people to come together to solve problems. And in the ed tech space, it makes great sense to also bring in the developers and the people that are creating and knowledgeable about the technology.
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. I mean, it really takes many people, many people's expertise to capitalize upon when we are thinking about how to make a high quality digital resource. So the beauty of a network is that you can draw on this collective experience and expertise. So I do mean really including several classrooms, several teachers, so that we have diverse experiences to bring to the table, and also including different disciplines when it comes to the research side, right? I mean, if you think about a simple app. It's actually quite complicated to design it, you know, in a way that it respects children's rights and all the ethical aspects are in place, as well as including insights from developmental psychology, cognitive sciences, and think about the educational values. So how do you make sure that children are not only engaged, but that you also hit some learning outcomes, and those learning outcomes should be linked also to socio-emotional outcomes. I mean, it can quickly get very complicated if you include learning sciences into this. So to have that kind of collective approach to this is, I think, something that hasn't been tried before. So we are, you know, experimenting here as we go. But hopefully through this kind of dialogue that draws on multiple perspectives and diverse perspectives, we can create a new generation of EdTech that is more aligned with the collective needs rather than the needs of a few individuals.
That's amazing. I love this approach. So I have so many questions as a researcher and as an instructor myself, and thinking about the broad range of educators who listen to this podcast. And I should focus on the questions that I think will help the most educators and teachers listening to this. And so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about AI, artificial intelligence, and what research has been done on AI and how it might improve student learning, or what research is missing and has not been done. Because I think there's a lot of discussions about how AI can be so great and can, you know, help teachers with their work, and how AI might be so awful and can really harm student learning or get in the way, sort of thinking about paper developing and cheating, so to speak. But I'm wondering if there's research showing that it can help student learning and can foster student learning, and what the quality of that research really is.
Oh, great questions. Well, I can tell you from the perspective of the discipline that I represent and where I have done some work myself, and I have seen some application of the research into practice, because this may be relevant for teachers who are perhaps considering the use of generative AI reading apps or various literacy tools that have Gen AI embedded in them, and perhaps wonder whether this is a good idea. So the work that we have done with colleagues has looked at two things. One is, put very simply, template-based AI, so looking at stories that come with some templates pre-designed for children and learners to use. So you can imagine that as a child, you're given a few avatars, perhaps some prompts, as a suggestion that you can put into the system, and the system generates a story that is unique and personalized to the child. That is, of course, a big benefit that we get with AI, in the sense that the stories that it can generate will be really unique, they will be original, and the children, the more they add their own prompts to it, the more the children will be getting personalized versions of these stories. The drawback here, of course, as we have heard in many media, the personal data protection issues are very prevalent here, especially with some commercial applications that haven't been checked for their privacy and algorithmic fairness and security aspects. So I would be a bit cautious about experimenting with these tools, because it may mean that, you know, children's data are not necessarily protected, and the benefit of seeing these many nice generated stories is not necessarily going to outweigh the drawbacks of mishandling children's data. The other kind of generative AI, that's seen being used for K-12 literacy materials are the so-called open-ended story generators. A bit like the bedtime AI and these various applications out there where families can create stories based on really open-ended suggestions. they are increasingly coming to schools too, because they can be used for personalized education. They can allow children's fantasy and imagination to flourish. This is what the providers will tell you. So for the teachers, I guess the question is, okay, how can I harness this technology in alignment with my pedagogical practice and in alignment with the curriculum that I am following? So increasingly, the applications that are being used in schools are actually matching the design with the specific curriculum objective. And what then happens is that you might be able to generate a story for a specific student in alignment with a specific curricular goal. For example, you want to teach phonics, so you'll be able to generate a story that targets phonics skills for this specific child, you know, by essentially adjusting some prompts in the generator. So there are some interesting use cases, but the difficulty for research, as you would know, so that we can really establish what works for whom, under which conditions and why, we need some time. And the pace of developing this technology and inserting it into various sessions and classroom instruction is so much more advanced than the pace of research that we are just catching up in terms of being able to say, okay, this is the actual added value for children's literacy, or this is what will be the added value for reading comprehension. So all we can do at this stage is, as researchers, looking back at some solid theories, some established meta-analyses that are telling us what works in children's digital reading, and applying those insights to these new generative AI tools so that we can provide some recommendations in terms of this may work and this is really not a good idea.
It seems to me like the claims that this should help with students' imagination and this should help with this, that, or the other are based on maybe theory or other research that has been done. Certainly, I don't think these specific tools have been experimentally tested. And I just did a video for the videos that we release for our Patreon supporters first, and then at the end of the year we make them all available to everybody. Kind of talking through and thinking about the difference between evidence-based recommendations and, or not the difference, but sort of the continuum of evidence-based recommendations when we test something very specific versus saying, well, you know, it worked in this context, so it also ought to work in this other context. And I think that continuum is becoming more and more important. I'm not sure we necessarily need to test every single AI app that ever is created experimentally in order to be able to say, you know, this type of AI works well in these scenarios and this type doesn't, or, you know, this doesn't have a very large effect or what have you. We don't need to test every single one, but certainly we ought to test the technology in some way, right? So there's a balance between sort of the, in research terms, the external and ecological validity and the ability to maintain internal validity, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would add to what you said, the importance of specificity of the research that different providers draw on or claim to draw on when they are saying that their app or platform is evidence-based. Because as you say, this continuum is out there, and it's extremely important that if someone claims that their tool is based on some evidence, that it has been verified by researchers who are not internal to the company, but are some, you know, third-party researchers who can really look in detail at the specific features of this app and think about how these features link to published studies. You know, like when our researchers do these, we call it like research-based theory of change, like looking at what is the possibility here in terms of reaching certain outcomes over time. So what we often do there is to do a review of the app and think about not only the evidence that sort of should support the features, but really the counter evidence, right? Like actually this may not work. And if there is a prevalence of features that have been shown of not being conducive to learning, then these kinds of feedbacks are really important to embed back into the product. So I guess this is where the teacher's role also becomes very important, because so that we can improve these tools out there in the market, we need to mobilize this kind of collaboration of testing and evaluating, not only by the researchers, looking at specific features, but also getting the actual insights of what is happening in the classrooms and observations. But I would caveat that with what you said at the beginning in terms of we don't want to be testing every single app that is out there. I mean, there are thousands of them out there, right? What we've been sort of trying to advocate for within the network is that we need to have some minimal standards, minimal quality standards before these apps come to classrooms, right? So that it is not the case that anyone can just knock on the door and use the very precious instruction time to be testing their app without having gone through some preliminary checks. You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also important for educators or administrators who are considering putting these technologies into their school systems or teachers using them in their classrooms. When someone says something is evidence-based, what is the comparison group too?
Right.
Because, you know, a technology that encourages students to read can be said to be evidence-based, and the evidence could be that reading improves literacy. The comparison group that is implied there is that somehow using this technology is better, produces more learning than standard reading instruction. But you can say that any app that promotes reading should promote literacy just like reading would, right? I mean, obviously, there can be differences there. It could be better or worse, but the comparison group really matters.
Right. And I think in the US, the ESSAR standards have done some good in the sense that there has been a progress in a collective understanding of evidence. But I suppose it's a very specific understanding of what it means to have an evidence-based edtech if you think about ESSA, right? So the Office of Educational Technology explains it very nicely on their website that, okay, in ESSA Tier 4, evidence means that, you know, this specific edtech solution has a logic model, they have a theory of change, they have some kind of plan to be testing empirically, they have been checked by researchers, they have a badge so that the schools can be more confident that the solution is based on some research, right? So it has been verified by some research groups that are external to the company. And as the company is then growing their research, they will be conducting more studies, some with control groups, some without control group, and depending on the weight of the evidence or the rigor of the study, they can be increasing the level of these ESSA standards. And as it is very much a bit of a controversial, topic in terms of is the top evidence here an RCT? Is that what is the top golden standard that we aim for with edtech technologies? Certainly, according to the ESSA standards, having an RCT with proper randomization and a highly rigorous study that would be considered in US standards with ESSA as the sort of top evidence. But I can tell you, as someone who works across the different countries, the RCT notion of sort of the golden standard in edtech evidence is not accepted across internationally. So for many teachers who might be working in classrooms outside of US, or maybe also in US, but perhaps not necessarily following this model of golden standard in terms of RCT, they may be thinking more along the lines of effectiveness studies, you know, action research, more local qualitative evidence feeding into the model. And personally, I don't think one or the other is wrong. I feel that the more evidence there is, the more empirical studies have been done with a specific solution, the more knowledge we have about, you know, when it works and how it works and what are the enabling and what are the inhibiting factors. So I feel there should be space for various kinds of research. But I don't know what you think. You come to this with your own disciplinary background.
I agree. I mean, I certainly, randomized control trials have a lot of benefits. They also are restrictive in some senses about the, I mean, in theory, you can ask any question with many questions with a randomized control trial, but in practice, you can't. And so I definitely think that when possible, the randomized control trial is going to give us what it is that we often want to know, which is what is, you know, is the effect causal? But it's not always the best if it means that there's less research. We just have to be really careful and think really critically about the type of research that we're looking at. And that goes for a randomized control trial as well. There's definitely a place for qualitative work and asking questions and getting more rich answers that can be analyzed in different ways and thinking about the benefits and the downsides of each research method and pulling those together, I think is the best approach.
I couldn't agree more. And you know, this is what learning sciences are about, right? This notion of methodological plurality, that we do need to have different methods for different research questions. And these different research questions will be then informed by different types of practice that are coming from teachers. So selecting the right method for the question we are asking, that is what leads to a high quality study, right? So I totally agree with you. Like, there is space for RCTs, and the specific solution needs to be mature enough so that it's ready to be tested in a big, expensive RCT trial. And there is also space for other types of studies that can tell us more about perhaps these contextual factors, right? Like, where does it work and why and so on. So, no, I do think that we need a bit of both, sort of both the efficacy and the effectiveness are together constructing what works. And the more we can have this broader vision of understanding evidence, I think the more it becomes attainable in terms of both testing in schools with various teachers groups and for the EdTech providers to care about research. Because it can be a bit off-putting, you know, if they hear that they need to do a big RCT, it might be unattainable for many of the providers out there. And I would really like to have the notion of collaboration with the industry in developing these tools rather than separating them from what is happening in the classrooms. I would love teachers' voices to be much more embedded in the design and in the evaluation process of EdTech.
Absolutely. So for the teachers listening, teachers or administrators who are thinking about multiple classrooms or maybe multiple school districts, what is your sort of best piece of advice or top recommendation when thinking about AI? And that's a very broad question. It could go in lots of different directions. But given the state of the research right now and the state of AI right now, what would you recommend for those who are interested in utilizing AI and maybe also for those who are skeptical about it or don't want to integrate it as much? What would you recommend?
Well, that's a big question.
If it's too big of a question, feel free to just take a piece of it and go.
I've been thinking a lot about AI and agency, you know, like children's agency, teachers' agency, and how is that being impacted by generative AI? And that is such a big topic. And I guess to sort of digest it into something that makes sense to the listeners and is not this sort of jumble of thoughts that I have in my head. You know, agency is at the core of human dignity. Agency is what makes us humans. And it is a two-edged sword. You can be thinking about agency in terms of self-determination, you know, so the volition, the possibility and ability to make choices. And on the other side of the spectrum, you have belonging and togetherness. That too is part of agency. And generative AI, because it is empowering so many processes that are human thinking processes, it cuts across these two, both the self-determination and the belonging part of agency. So I guess what is very important for us all, not only for educators, but also for researchers and developers and parents and families to consider with Gen AI technologies is, what does the tool do to my agency? And by extension, if we are the gatekeepers for children's use of these tools, what does it do for the child's agency? And there to be really thinking about this balance between self-determination choices versus collective agency, belonging to others, togetherness. Because I feel that at the moment, the balance is a bit tilted towards the self-determination part when you speak to many optimists around Gen AI, right? That we are empowering children, that we have these highly personalized tutors who can be really promoting each individual child's education. But we are forgetting a little bit this collective part there, I feel. And I guess I'll stop there because otherwise I'll be just talking forever about this, Megan. I don't know whether that's sufficient to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's related to your book. So, right? So you wrote a book, The Future of the Self, describing these ideas about personalized learning and AI. And I wonder if you maybe want to share a little bit about your book.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I mean, the idea of agency being this two-sided spectrum of self-determination and belonging that is described in the book, where I was trying to summarize research that talks about this increasing acceleration of education, you know, like this push for more and more data on children, faster and better technologies, and trying to sort of present a different perspective on it, making us reflect on whether this is the right path to follow and what we can do in terms of finding an optimal balance between two sides of humanity, really, you know, that we want to ensure that we personalize, but at the same time, we need to think about diversity and pluralization. So I talk a lot about this PP balance, personalization and pluralization balance, because in the current education systems, it tends to go either the standardized way or the personalized way. And finding a balance between the two is something that Gen AI at the moment is not doing. It's pushing more the personalized agenda. So I'm very curious to see where this all goes.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or that you'd like to share?
Oh, I think we covered so much.
I think so too. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this conversation so much, and I will put into the show notes the links that you mentioned about the children's digital books. I will put a link to your book, The Future of the Self.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This episode is funded by listeners like you. To support our work and gain access to exclusive content, visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/learningscientists.